Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall. I'm your co-host, Willie B. And as always, we are coming to you from the outskirts of the greatest territory in wrestling history, Memphis, Tennessee. And here to introduce today's special guest is the founder, promoter, and CEO of this podcast, my tag team partner, Mayor McCall.
Willie B., I've been so excited for this one. We have a very special guest today. He comes from the oldest and largest professional wrestling family in the world. Saddle up and take a ride. Welcome to ringside and take a seat. He is the leader and creator of the Stud Stable. He is the host of the viral podcast, The Studcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the Mississippi Mayor brings to you the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Hey guys, how y'all doing?
Doing well. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. I'm really really glad to be on with you.
We appreciate you.
And you're in one of the greatest wrestling cities in the world. No doubt about that.
Well, yes, sir. Well, tell us a little bit about your history in Memphis. We know that your family has been in the wrestling business for four generations. Will you tell us a little bit about how your family got started in the wrestling business?
Well, my granddad, Roy Welch, started in 1920, about 100 years ago, man,
wow.
1922, in Columbus, Ohio. He trained out there in Amarillo, Texas, with a guy named Dutch Mantell, the original Dutch Mantell.
Ah, okay.
Not the Dutch we know, you know, but
not the guy from Walshaw, Texas.
Yeah. The original Dutch was an old-time shooter, man. Wow, what a great story he is in himself. We could spend an hour on Dutch Mantell, the original. But my granddad started in Ohio, wrestled for about 5 years in Ohio, and decided that he wanted to be a promoter. He wanted to start his own company, and he traveled into Tennessee. Actually, he settled in Dyersburg, Tennessee, of all places, and he started piecing together a territory. You know that back in those days there was no territory, it was very little wrestling of any kind, and so he started expanding. At one time, probably by the 1950s, he was in 12 states in the South. And controlled everything basically from the Gulf of Mexico to darn near Ohio.
Wow.
He was like the start of it for our family. He had a couple of brothers. He actually had three brothers. They were great wrestlers. Herb Welch, big name in Memphis for many, many years. Lester Welch. And they had a guy, another brother named Jack, who wrestled for a while, but he didn't really stick with it for a lifetime. The other guys all did, obviously. And then second generation came along in the family. Roy had a son named Edward, and then Dad changed his name when he started wrestling to Fuller. So my brother and I took the Fuller name. But Herb had a couple of sons that wrestled. Lester had two sons that wrestled. Jack had a daughter that wrestled. So, the second generation was fairly large. And then the third generation came along. There was another group of family members named the Fields. Hatfields, that was his name. Virgil Hatfield was married one of Roy's sisters. And they had three sons, and they changed their name to the Fields Brothers. They end up actually buying my dad out of the Gulf Coast Territory. That Roy sent him down there to create a territory in 1954.
The Fields, I don't mean to interrupt you, Ron, but the Fields, was that Bobby, Don, and Lee?
That's them.
We had Shane Russell, the son of, you know, the greatest wrestling commentator, announcer in the whole wide world, Lance Russell. We had Shane Russell on, and he's a big, big fan of the Fields. He loves the Fields.
Yeah, I mean, those boys were very, very talented. Their dad was a referee, and that's how we got to be the largest family in wrestling. I mean, we had promoters and just all kinds of different people involved. Referees, some were referees, some were promoters, some owned territories. Wow, it's just a It's a big family, a huge family, and we had some great success in the South. We actually started just about most of the South. My granddad Roy, and then to get it to where Memphis was. Obviously Roy was in Tennessee. He was in Tennessee. He was in Arkansas. He was in Missouri. He was in Louisiana. He was in Alabama. He was in Mississippi. He was in West Virginia and Virginia. He was at Kentucky. He even Indiana, over in the Evansville area. So, you know, he created a monster territory back in the 30s.
And so this is, and to recap, this is a little bit before, or this is before all the territories kind of broke up into separate areas where you'd have Nashville, you'd have Memphis, you'd have, Mid-Atlantic and Florida. You know, your grandfather or your great-grandfather, you know, they just, your father and grandfather, they expanded, you know, about a fourth of the entire United States.
Yeah. He had the biggest territory probably has ever created. And he controlled most of it. And it got so big that about around 1948, he had to have somebody come in to help him with his territory. Somebody to run the office for him. Roy could take care of the wrestlers and all of that part of it. But that's where Nick Gulas got involved. Uh-huh. So Nick Gulas came in about 1948. 1948, Roy was so big that he was one of the founders of the National Wrestling Alliance. One of the eight founders of the alliance that finally grew to 30 or 40 different territories in the National Wrestling Alliance. So, you know, he was one of the founding fathers of professional wrestling, in the South.
And he would have been a voting member for deciding who the world champion was, is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was one of the eight founders that started it all.
Incredible.
So, you know, and that thing just grew to be a huge organization, and my dad was a part of it. I was a part of it with my territories. And, you know, it was a big deal to be back as far as he was and to piece together all the things that he did and accomplish what he did. And besides that, he owned a dairy in Yorkville, Tennessee that was one of the biggest dairies in the South. So, you know, he didn't just run a wrestling company. He ran one of the biggest dairies in that part of the country, too.
So a true businessman.
Yeah, he was a true businessman and kind of a freak, too, man, in a lot of ways. Guys were scared to death of him. Wrestlers were scared, horrified of him. And a lot of the old timers that I talked to when I was a young boy would say, "Your granddaddy's a man." He goes, "Wow, your granddaddy, oh, don't know. Nobody messes with him." So Roy he stiff-armed his way into a lot of opening his territory. There were a few little towns around I asked him how he built his territory, and he said, there was a few people that were running wrestling when I came here in the night, about 1930, and I would shut down all their operation. I said, "Well, how'd you do that?" And he said, "Well, I'd just go in to find a town, and when they were running," he said, "I would go into the where the dressing room was," and he said, "I'd kick the door open and walk inside. I'd introduce myself," and he said, "I would tell them all that this is your last wrestling. In fact, you can put your stuff on and leave now. You're done." And then he said, "I'd go to the other dressing room," and then he said, "I'd look up the promoter," and he said, "I would tell the promoter, don't ever run another wrestling event. Don't ever see you do this anymore. You know nothing about it." So he kind of strong-armed his way into building a major territory, basically from darn near Ohio to the Gulf Coast.
So it sounds like wrestling, especially back then, was a cutthroat business.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know that everybody did it that way, you know, but Roy was a pretty tough old son of a gun, and everybody knew it, and nobody wanted to mess with him. And so, you know, he kind of set himself up into a good territory, and they built a big business there. And Memphis was always a good wrestling city, you know. And Roy told me, my brother and I, we'd go visit him. And I have a cousin, Jimmy Golden, Yeah. Golden family is part of our, part of the Welch's too. Jimmy's mother is a Welch. And then Jimmy's father was a promoter, Bill Golden, and there was a Philip Golden that promoted towns up in, I think, in Arkansas and into Missouri. So, just a huge monstrous family, and, we've spent a lot of time, all of us have worked in Memphis at one time or another, basically all the way back to Roy's time. Herb was a big star there for many, many years. And then Lester came along. Lester was younger. He was about the same age as my dad. He was 20 years younger than Roy and Herb. They all kind of came through Memphis at one time or another. And my dad ended up in Memphis about 1960. When Dad got started, Lester was starting at that time, and Roy was putting guys in the family in different parts of the country, where he wanted to get control.
Right.
So he had control, obviously. He had family members there. They were promoters, and not just wrestlers, but they were promoters too, and a lot of them were the bookers as well. And so, he could control things a whole lot better. He sent my dad, when I was about 3 years old, he sent us from Dyersburg, Tennessee, sent Dad to Kingsport, the Tri-Cities area, on the east side of Tennessee, and Dad ran that area there for a while, and then Roy called him up and he said, I want to open up on the Gulf Coast. And he sent Dad down there. He told him, he said, I wanted you to run everything from Tallahassee to New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
And so Dad was, about my age when I became a promoter, about 25, 26 years old. And he went down to the Gulf Coast, and he did what Roy told him, and created a tremendous territory down there.
How many nights a week did they run, and how many shows per night was he doing?
Well, Roy's territory was unbelievable. In the 1950s, Roy would run 40 towns a week.
Wow!
Whoa.
And so they were running six towns a night. Six, seven sounds a night.
That's insane. That's
every night.
Ooh.
Yeah, and like I said, the towns were, it'd be anywhere from Kentucky south to the Gulf of Mexico.
And how would that work if you're running a town? Obviously the promoter can't be at every town. So how would that work? Did you have a boss, someone? I don't know what the term today would be, the booker, whoever it was in charge of each town. How would that work?
Well, he, like I said, he had a lot of cronies, a lot of guys that would work for him. Some of them had been wrestlers, and some of them had been referees. When they got too old to wrestle or too old to referee, he would change their jobs. He would say, look, I want you to run Missouri.
Ah, okay.
I want you to run the little towns in Missouri over here. And another guy says, you're going to run the Arkansas towns. And so he had somebody that he could control and somebody he could trust to run in towns, all the towns.
Gotcha.
And, he had a heck of an organization going. It was a huge organization.
That's what I was getting at, is how, because back then, you think about it, that there is no, even mail probably ran slow. So just to be able, there's the communication, you have to go find a phone, and just to, just being able to run that many towns, that many territories, and that many, it's incredible.
Yeah, he had probably 150 wrestlers.
Okay.
Back in the 50s, the late 40s into the 50s. My granddad also trained the first wrestling bear to wrestle.
Ah.
In the late 30s. In the late 1930s, just before World War II, and that's a strange story too. He was coming home from West Virginia. He was by himself. He drove. They used to make trips from this to the, how big the territory was. They used to make trips, if you can imagine this, in the 1930s, from Dyersburg, Tennessee to Bluefield, West Virginia. Two-lane road.
And knowing those cars probably didn't go over 50 to 60 miles an hour.
Model T's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, cars weren't real fast. And he was coming home out of West Virginia, and he came upon a mama bear that had been hit by a car. And she was killed. She was laying in the road, and her cub was there. And, you know, he said he got out, and, you know, he said the cub was so small, you know, that he wasn't where he was going to harm him, or, you know, Roy wasn't going to hurt him, obviously. And so he said that then he got to thinking, you know, if I leave this cub here and somebody comes along and they hit the cub, because a cub was just staying with the mama, you know. And
right.
So he said, you know, I can't leave him here, you know. And so he said he took him in, put him in the trunk of his car, and he took him home. And he fed that bear and trained the bear to be a wrestling bear.
Wow.
The new star of the territory.
New star. Oh, wow. And you know, because he was the first, it was such a tremendous, you couldn't see wrestling bears back in those days. Nobody had one, right? So it was about the time of World War II was starting, and Roy was too old to go to war, and so he took the bear, because, you know, business, there wasn't much wrestling business. It was very hard to draw money. Obviously, the war's going on. All the men are fighting the war. And he took the bear on a trip. They built a cage for her and put him on the back of his car, and he took her on a world tour. He took her all the way down into the south of Mexico. He toured Mexico, he toured the United States, he toured Canada with her. He took her on a 3-year trip.
Man.
The bear.
The origin of sports entertainment as we know it today.
I'm telling you, man, you know. And I asked him. I asked him a lot of questions about a lot of things. And he told me. I said, how did she draw? And he goes, you know, he said mostly all women came, you know, but he said it was such an unusual event. He goes, never failed to sell out. He said never had a town went to that we didn't sell out. You know, and so
my granddad, if you think about it. That came along at a perfect time. If all the men are fighting in overseas, you know, you only have a very small, or you've cut your audience over at half, because, you know, majority are probably men even back then. So having that bear, you know, just to bring the ladies that are probably working the factories or working, taking up the slack for the men that are overseas, that had to have been, you know, that had been quite the attraction.
Oh yeah, it was a genius idea, you know. And I mean, he pieced it all together and he took off, you know, just to give you an idea of what my granddad was all about. You know, I got a little story. When I was a boy, about 12 years old, he used to take me to Memphis with him. We would go from Yorkville to Memphis, because in Memphis, he liked to go to Memphis. It was one of the major cities in all of his territory. And he, so I would ride along with him sometimes, and he would tell me stories about, you know, he used to ask me, he asked me one time, he says, what do you do if you get in a fight with somebody and you can't beat him, you know? And I said, I gotcha, I don't know. Well, what do you do? And he said, well, if you can't beat him, you eat him. And I said, what do you mean you eat him? And he says, well, you get one finger in your mouth and you eat that finger off, then you eat off the next finger, and then you eat off the hand, and then you eat off the arm. And, you know, so he was a pretty far out dude.
And I just got to ask, on behalf of the animal rights activists, you know, all around the world, was the bear happy with the payoff every night?
He took great care of his bear. And in fact, his bear was the only bear, I think, that ever wrestled that had all her claws and all her teeth.
Wow.
You know,
and she still,
after that.
How many accidents, or did she harm anybody, or?
Oh, well, you know, she was horrified of Roy. Because Roy had trained her, and I mean, he had brought her up basically, and you know, I asked him one time, I said, how did you make the bear mind you? you know? And he said, I'd slap her, you know? And I said, I heard bears do the slapping, man.
Well, he instilled fear. He was the alpha. So
he was the alpha. Yeah. And he, from the very beginning, and the bear was always horrified of him. And so he never had to pull her claws out nor her teeth. He would put mittens on her feet and he put muzzle on her face.
Yep.
So that she couldn't bite anybody. The one time a guy got his finger in the one of the holes in the muzzle, because the muzzle had to be cold in it so she could breathe, and she bit this guy's finger off one time.
Ooh.
You know, that was about as bad a deal as not actually the worst deal that ever happened, but Roy used to stake her out in the backyard and wherever he lived, you know, and they moved out of Dyersburg into Yorkville. He still had the bear at that time. And so my dad was about 12 years old, and my dad brought a bunch of young friends he had, young boys. Obviously, they knew Roy had a bear. So, you know, all of dad's friends or younger boys, they wanted to see the bear. So my dad one time took a bunch of his buddies, and they went to the backyard. Roy had the bear staked out, and Roy was on the far side of the house. Roy did the first thing with bears. This is what everybody that ever had a bear after Roy always did, the same deal. At the end, Roy would give the bear a Coke pop, Coke. And she'd sit up on her butt and she'd drink the Coca-Cola. It was the way he ended every match. And obviously, it was done to reward the bear.
Yeah. Right?
So anyway, my dad, he got those boys there, and then he got the bright idea. He says, you know, I'm going to get me a Coke and give her a Coke, right? Well, he's not supposed to be close to her. She would go after people that, you know, what, anybody but Roy. So dad got a bottle, but he didn't have Coke in it, and he put water in it. So then he went over to try to get her, to reach out there where he get her. She was on the chain, and so she got out. He thought she was at the very end of her chain, and he reached out and set down the Coke bottle. And when she got the bottle, she picked it up and she set up to drink it. As soon as she realized it wasn't Coke, she dropped down there, and he was too close to her, and she grabbed him by the back of the leg. She drug him underneath her. She tore his thigh out, bit through his thigh. She was trying to kill him. She was trying to bite him in the stomach, and he got his hands in her mouth, and his hands were all bit up. And he got head scars the rest of his life on his legs where she had got him. But no, a bear almost killed him. I wouldn't be talking to you guys if Roy hadn't have been there. Roy heard him screaming, and he ran around, screamed at the bear. The bear ran, but that was a strange life, man. We come from a really strange family, no doubt about that.
That's one of the most interesting stories I've ever heard during the show or in wrestling, period.
I don't know that we can top that one.
Ron, I want to talk about the importance and greatness of your father, Buddy Fuller. So your grandfather Roy Welch, he had sent your, if I'm not mistaken, he had sent your father down to like Mobile, like the Gulf Coast area, to promote and wrestle and build that territory up. Correct.
Right.
So around, what was it, around like 1958, 59? Your dad, like Ladd Stadium, like with in front of 40,000 people, went against Mario Galente with Joe Louis reffing. Talk to us about that.
Dad did some tremendous crowds in all the territories that he ever put together. We went to Mobile in 1954. I was in the first grade, and nobody had ever wrestled along the Gulf Coast. There'd never been any wrestling of any kind along the Gulf Coast. TV stations were just opening up, and that's what really made wrestling huge, was television. So, he got on Mobile TV, they had TV, got on New Orleans, he got on, several TV stations all along the Gulf Coast there, and he slowly built his company. Dad was a really smart promoter. He was actually a welder. Before he went into wrestling, he went to Chicago and got a job welding when he just came back after the war, basically after he was in World War II. And when he came back after the war, he became a welder. So he would make his own wrestling rings. He would build his own wrestling arena, build the bleachers, all the things that was necessary to have these outside arenas, which here along the Gulf Coast, it made sense. And a lot of the shows were outside. Then he worked an angle, Mario Galento, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with him, right? And I know that he had an altercation with Jerry Jarrett and those guys on TV in Mobile.
If I'm not mistaken, he's a fellow that ended up losing the eye.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he actually lost his eye, but yeah, he had a problem with Jarrett and a couple of other people. Galento was pretty far out there dude himself. He was so tough, Galento, that he would bust. My dad used to pay guys in the territory down there in Mobile $25 to do a hard way. Know what a hard way is?
No, sir.
I want to take a stab at this. Is that where actually you're talking about where being like a real shooter, like somebody maybe comes from the crowd and challenges them or something like that?
Well, what a hard way was is the guys started using the blades to cut themselves back in the day of, I guess back in the early 50s or so. But if you really wanted to do it right, the way my old man and way Roy would tell you is you would hard way. You let a guy hit you in the eye hard enough to bust your eye.
Ooh.
And that not only left you with stitches in your eye, but lots of times it left you with a big black eye. You were the greatest advertisement for the sport being real that could be, right? So my dad worked this angle with Galento in Mobile, Alabama, and building up toward the Ladd Stadium show, in which they drew about 40,000 people, in which they got into a fight in a restaurant. They came into the restaurant, got in a fight. They fought outside the restaurant. Dad grabbed Galento by the back of the head. Galento had long black hair, and he slammed his face into Dad's Cadillac hood. Hard enough to beat the dent of Cadillac hood. Back in those days, in the 50s, Cadillacs were made out of pretty substantial material.
Yeah, what was it, fiberglass?
yeah, it was no fiberglass, no.
That's a hell of a way to promote a wrestling show.
Yeah, I mean, so they fought all, and they were so over at that point that people believed it was real because a lot of guys were doing hard ways. And so a lot of his crew would be walking around town all the time. They were welcomed with big old black eyes, and Galento, like I was about to tell you, Dad would pay his guys in the territory $25 for a hard way. If you got a hard way, you came and showed him your face and got your stitches, whatever, he'd pay you an extra buck. Dad said Galento would sometimes make $150 a week extra. He'd get a hard way every night.
Good grief.
And he wouldn't even get sewn up. He didn't want to get. He didn't take Novocaine shots. He would just say, "Saw this show. Sew me up, Doc. Don't mess with the needle. Just sew it up." You know. He was a pretty darn tough guy. So they went to. They got this match together, and like I said, they drew about 40,000 people in the Ladd Stadium, big huge stadium where they used to play the Senior Bowls and shit. For football.
Yep.
But anyway, they had a match that only lasted 5 minutes with Joe Louis, and every other punch Dad said that they threw was a hard way. Galento had 46 stitches in one eye. I don't know if you've ever seen the picture of Mario Galento after that match. Well, I need to send y'all a picture so you can see this. But it was a picture that was taken after that match, about actually probably a week after the match, Lento's eyes were still black. You could see all the stitches in one eye. The other eye was busted too. It had stitches in it too, but one eye was busted in like six places. And Dad's eyes were so closed. I can remember as a kid, I was in the second grade, that for 2 weeks, Mom had to drive him everywhere. He couldn't see to drive. She'd have to drive him wherever he was going to go. And I remember me and Rob watching him go to the mirror one day on the wall over on the house, and he his eyes were still so swollen that he got one, and he reached and got one eye, and he pulled his eyelid, spread his eyelid open, and blood squirted out on the mirror.
So let's recap, it was the real thing. Let's recap for the fans as we go. So far your family is credited for sports entertainment. Now we find out that your family is responsible for the origin of hardcore wrestling.
yeah, definitely. Dad carried that onward. He didn't stop with Mobile. We went to Arizona. After we went into Memphis, and most of Dad's really what Dad really accomplished was in Memphis. Because once he left Mobile, he went to Memphis, and Dad made a lot of money. He ran a great company, obviously he was sending. He was like 10% always went back to the Nashville, and that's the way Roy ran his territory, is he couldn't be in all those towns, but he put the promoters there, and then whatever the house was, 10% went back to Nashville. So Roy did very well. Dad did well, and so Dad went into Memphis. Memphis got down in about 19 in the mid 50s. Memphis was not drawing nearly what it used to draw. Have you guys ever heard of a guy named Les Wolf?
Yes.
Okay, Les Wolf was a promoter there. When we went there as a kid, I went there. I think it was the fifth grade. We moved from Mobile to Memphis. Memphis was dead. It was so bad that Ellis Auditorium, y'all know that building?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Okay, Ellis Auditorium, if you can imagine this, the first night I ever went to a match and I stood on the stage there in Ellis Auditorium, there wasn't 300 people in Ellis Auditorium.
How many did Ellis would hold, around 5,000 people?
No, I mean, it had the two sides to it, right? It had the little auditorium back across the stage. They had the big curtain, the steel curtain that dropped down, that separated the building. So it was like two arenas. The big side would hold about 6,000. It was around 6,000, maybe even 7,000.
Wow.
And then on the opposite side, on the auditorium side, they had about 2,000 seats on that side. So Dad goes in the first night in Memphis that I can remember as a kid. There wasn't two rows full of ringside people. And I saw him down there talking to ringside fans. And I asked him as a kid, I watched things, and I said, I said, Dad, what were you talking about down there to the fans? And he said, I was telling them all that your seats are taken. You're out of here. I don't want you to ever come back to another wrestling.
He kicked all the ringside ticket holders out.
Kicked all the ringside holders out because their attitudes were so bad. They'd seen such bullshit, and the business was down and horrible. He couldn't build the business back by having that group of people there in the front two rows. So, he basically closed his town down. He went from 300 people to 150 people, and then he started building from there. Within 2 years, he would sell out the big side of Ellis, okay? And then I remember when I was a kid, that Ellis Auditorium, it was a beautiful structure. And they had this big stage that had a curtain. It was a steel curtain. It was probably like a foot thick, and it raised up and went and it dropped down. So every night when they ran wrestling, if there was nothing going on in the other side of the building and the wrestling sold out at the big side, they would sell tickets into the auditorium side. And when it came time for the bell to ring, the bell would ring. This was really, for a kid, for anybody, it was a beautiful experience. The bell would ring, and then they would slowly start to draw up this huge curtain so that the people in one side of the building could see the people in the other side. And then they would start cheering at each other back and forth, the people that were in the auditorium side. Then the building went from 8,000 people to 10,000 people. You know, it connected to where the people could see through the stage area into the ring in the major building, in the big building.
And let's tell everybody, too, what a genius your dad was and how he was able to accomplish that. He was like the king of marketing. He made, you know, he was responsible for Memphis exploding. Like you said, he came in, he kicked the ringside, you know, ticket holders out. They had been loyal, but they were not good for the business. And he just went on like a marketing, like advertising spree. He was using like side of like buses, like taxi cabs. Like I've seen where your dad was, you know, one of his famous lines, wrestling made television, television made wrestling. He was like the king of marketing. So I wanted to give him his due, you know, props and respect on that.
Yeah, I mean, he spent more money on marketing than probably any promoter anywhere in the history of wrestling. That's how he built the Mobile area. That's how he got 40,000 fans. You got to have something good going on to get 40,000 people to show up at anything, right? So, he did the same thing. He is the one that took HBQ, or I think that's Channel 5.
He's Channel 13. The one that, Channel 13.
WHBQ.
13. Yep. Okay, 13. He's the one that made that an hour and a half live show. Nobody had ever done a live show. And, they've done a lot of live shows, but nobody had ever done an hour and a half, a 90-minute one. He's the one that hired Lance Russell. That's where Lance got his job from. My dad hired Lance Russell, who was young at the station there, Baron, back in that time. And, they had a great program. Dad had the super talent, just really super talent. He ran the event. He had the Cadillac tournament with Billy Wicks and Sputnik Monroe, he had Joe Louis again as a referee in that event. And he ran into baseball stadium there because it was too big an event to go anywhere else. Kind of like what happened in Mobile with Ladd Stadium, biggest venue in all of Memphis during that time was the baseball stadium.
Yeah.
And I remember my brother and I didn't get to go to many of those things, but he let us go to that night's matches. And we sat on the, like out in the, you know, the center field area. And they had a...
Were you around 12 years old at that time?
That's it. I was 12 years old. I was in the sixth grade. I'll never forget it. I never forget this experience that night, to going and seeing that match. And they had brought the Cadillac that it was going to be given to the winner. They drove it out and parked it in center field. And they got it in. I remember being there early, and they opened the gate. In center field, they had a gate out there. You couldn't tell it was a gate, but there was a gate in center field. They opened the gate. They drove the car in through the gate, and they closed the gate back. And then I watched the match. There again, Sputnik Monroe, Hardwade, Billy Wicks, Hardquade, Monroe too. Both of them were bloody, and both of them were real busted. They were both hard ways. And Wicks won the car, and he was bleeding, obviously. Brand new Cadillac. And so when he gets out of the ring, the crowd was so massive that there was no room on the infield or the outfield. They sold out all the stands. Then they sold out all the ringside. Then they sold out the standing room only for the baseball field. So you could not even see the Cadillac parked out there, you know, when the match started, because there were so many people in the baseball stadium. The biggest crowd, obviously, ever had there. And they had the big street out there, Commercial Boulevard. Is that it? Maybe. I don't remember the name.
Sounds about right. Sounds about right.
Yeah. Big street right behind the baseball stadium. When you came out of the back, you went out onto this big street.
Would that have been Club Stadium?
It might have been, I don't remember the name of the stadium, but I remember it was a big stadium. It was probably, it was 20,000 plus, I'm sure. 20,000 plus fans, you know, and it may have been as close to 30. Anyway, Monroe busted Wick's eyes, and then Wick's went and got in the Cadillac. And when he got in the Cadillac, he couldn't drive. The plan was he was going to drive the Cadillac out of the gate and go home, right? But when he got in the car, there were so many people on the field, and they came crawling over the bleachers out onto the field, too, when the match was over, to go out there and be a part of it. And so they couldn't get there. He couldn't get his car turned around, get out of there. And the people, this was an amazing scene. The people got around that Cadillac. They picked up that Cadillac with him in it, and they carried that Cadillac out of the baseball stadium and put it down in the street.
Wow.
That's unbelievable stuff back in those days.
So would that Cadillac have been a loaner from a local dealer? Did your dad actually buy it? How did that work?
Yeah, Dad bought the car. Dad bought the car, and then the guy that won it, Wicks, won the car, and Wicks, I think, probably paid half of what Dad paid for the car.
Gotcha.
And I did the same things in my companies, man. I had Cadillac tournaments, and they were always great deals to have, and a good promotion and big crowds. It was a great event to build the support. And basically, I don't know that Memphis ever got a whole lot bigger than that, man, when it came to an event, a wrestling event. But yeah, Dad used everything, all types of advertising, everything possible to make a business good. And had one of the very best TV shows in the country, in the world, maybe ever, you know.
Yes, and you know they can't show up if they don't know about it. So that was a smart marketing on his part. But the channel, you know, the Channel 13 and later Channel 5, the TV is can't be understated. What it meant to the wrestling business in general, but especially Memphis wrestling, and the reach that it had, and the fact that at one point, and I could be wrong, someone's gonna hear this and correct me, but it would be 80% of the TV market on any Saturday morning back in the day when you had three channels would be watching Channel 13 or later Channel 5. It was that big of a deal to see wrestling on TV.
Yeah, that, you know, that was called a share. It was an 80 share. Because when you got your books, four times a year, television stations took their ratings, and the Arbitron and Nielsen books, and the Nielsen books came out. In Knoxville, I had an 80 share.
Wow.
Southeastern and Knoxville had an 80 share. 80% of the homes watching TV were watching your show. When you get that type of audience, you're going to sell out wherever you've got.
Yes.
You know, you've got that many people watching it at home, they're going to buy a ticket. And you can get that. And I was able to get that, too, when once I started my first company in Knoxville in 1974, Southeastern. I was there till 79. Then I went down and bought out the Fields brothers, who had bought out my father when he left there to go to Memphis. I bought the Fields brothers out, and I was able to hit those 80 shares all along the Gulf Coast TVs again. They hadn't been that good in years, or was able to build a television program that was good enough to get to that 80 share. When you do that, you're going to get some big crowds, man.
So what was your when you took over and you said you increased the crowds, what was the difference? Was it your booking, how you marketed, all the above, the talent you brought in? What was the key to your success?
Well, I kind of did, I kind of copied my dad in ways. I did a lot of advertising.
Mirror image.
I went beyond what he did. I got into billboards.
Okay.
I got to, because billboards were, to me, they were the highest profile advertising basically that you could do back in those days. And I kind of did that once I left wrestling in 1988, and I got a hockey team. I got into hockey.
Ah.
I had a hockey team in Nashville.
Before the Predators,
I'm the reason the Predators
came. There you go.
Came. Yeah. We went in there in 1989, me and a partner. And we took hockey into Nashville. We created the opening, game opening, which had never had a game opening in the history of hockey. And we bought the freeway billboard, not just the regular old time billboards, the freeway billboard.
And, so, speaking of athletics, I read in your biography that you played basketball at the University of Miami. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
3-year letterman.
Yeah. Yeah, I played my first year at Clemson, and then I transferred and finished Miami, University of Miami. Wow.
If you don't know, the Tennessee stud is 6'9"
yes,
inches,
that's
ladies
what
and
I was
gentlemen.
About to get at. That you're not exactly a short man. So,
no.
Yeah, did that was let the folks know it's not just professional wrestling. You were a true Division I athlete. What I read is a 3-year letterman. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but playing college, Division I college basketball. So, University of Miami.
Yeah, yep. You know, and I think I might have could have even played a little pro ball if I had really wanted to. But I always wanted to be a wrestler. I mean, I grew up around it all my life, and
truthfully, back in those days, there was probably more money in you and your family business being a wrestler than there would have been playing the NBA.
You're right. You're right.
That's what a lot of people may not understand.
That was part of my decision making too.
Yes,
that was part of my decision making too. You know, I mean, I was looking at what an NBA player was making, and then I was thinking, you know, what can I make wrestling? You know, and I know I was making more money wrestling my first few years than I would have made in the NBA.
And it wasn't hard to follow in the footsteps, because not only did your granddad and dad do it, they were damn good at it. They were the models for success.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they were pretty darn good, yes, and they had both had great success. Dad had great success wherever he went as a promoter. We went from Mobile to Memphis. Memphis became a monster territory. Then there's a lot of controversy about what actually happened. Dad basically got pushed out of Memphis.
Okay.
He never really sold Memphis. The athletic commission was kind of Nick and Roy, and Memphis had become such a huge commodity, man, as far as the wrestling was concerned, they basically had the control of the athletic commission in the state of Tennessee, and Roy controlled all those states. One thing that helped him keep his territory together is he set up all these athletic commissions in all these states. Years back, for 20 years, he had control of who was on the boards and who was on the commission. He could keep people out of the territory. He could control what he wanted. And they kind of pushed Dad out of Memphis without actually ever paying him for it, anything for it.
That would have been Gulas, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. 1960. It was 1960 that we left Memphis, and we went to live in a little town, Potts Camp, Mississippi.
Yeah. Not too far from south from us.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, we went out. He went from wrestling to a farming. We had 2,000 acre farm, and. Wow, what a change in lifestyle that was. But then eventually Dad went back to wrestling business. So he went to Arizona, which was a state that had never had any success with professional wrestling, and lit it up, just like Memphis. Man, same type of deal. It took 2 years, and that was a normal scenario. It would take him 2-3 years to take it from dead to monster, and then he'd like to sell it.
He had a plan, and he knew what he was doing. He'd go in there, he would tear it down, build it back up, and like you said, he would sell it. But he knew, but he had a formula of what it took to revive or, you know, resurrect a wrestling promotion.
Yeah, and I think, so you mentioned that, you know, he had his troop. He had his normal group that had started with him in 1954 of Sputnik Monroe and the great baby faces, and he knew how to. They all knew what the MO was. They knew what the territory. We're going to go in there. We're going to suffer. We're going to be hungry, and then we're going to finally end up filling our pockets. You know, they knew that he was going to make it happen.
And we're going to do a couple of hard ways.
Yeah, and oh yeah, that was part of the deal, and I mean it was kind of a requirement from Dad as far as I was concerned. But he did it himself. I mean, it wasn't like he required other guys to do it, and he never do it. He actually did it. So we spent time in Arizona. We moved from Arizona into Atlanta.
Ah.
He became partners with Ray Gunkel in Atlanta. Bought half of Atlanta.
Was that Mid-Atlantic? And, territory?
No.
Different territory?
No, it was the Georgia territory.
Georgia territory. My fault. Georgia territory. Yes.
Yeah, it was the Georgia territory, and there was Georgia territory was really strange. It had Atlanta and Savannah were owned by my dad and Gunkel, and it had a promoter in Columbus, Georgia, and Macon, Georgia, Fred Ward, that had basically owned the other part of Georgia. But that territory was down. Dad went in there, it was dead in 64, and by 1966, 1967, he ran a baseball stadium show in Ponce de Leon Park with him and Galento again.
Ah.
This time refereed by Rocky Marciano.
And, so he loved to bring in the boxers, the former World Heavyweight Champions.
He liked to bring in the old heavyweight boxing champions, yep. Which was a great gimmick. It was a
Absolutely.
Great idea.
I mean, again, you know, look what happened in 1998 when, you know, this guy named Mike Tyson was a special referee at WrestleMania 13 for McMahon. So, again, it goes back to show what your family did was imitated and used, you know, 30, 40, 50 years later.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they did things that they worked. It just worked, and it was a natural fix. Dad did a hard way that night in Atlanta, and that show there, around 30,000 people, whatever Ponce de Leon baseball stadium would hold. It was packed. It was just like the baseball stadium that looking in Memphis. You know, it was just 10 years later, but same scenario, man. Big old stadium, just crammed full, and you know. He was pretty amazing. He was really, really good at what he did, and you know, and I learned a lot as a kid watching all of these things. And then, you know, that's what I wanted to do once I got started. Me and Rob in 1970, we worked in Georgia, and then I went to Florida, and Rob went to Tennessee. As a matter of fact, he worked that one. He got his big start in Tennessee, and I went down to Florida, and Then I started my first company in 1974.
Let's talk about that. How did that come about? Was it something you knew that you wanted to do, or it was, you know, what pushed you to go ahead and pull the trigger?
Well, I'd always wanted to be a promoter too. I'd always wanted to do what my dad did. I really believe my dad always wanted to do what his dad did.
Yep.
And I think, you know, he wanted to be more than a wrestler. He wanted to be an owner. He wanted to build it. He wanted to see the full stadiums. And, you know, he wanted to, that was all a thrill for you. You know, when you work for something and it goes great, and then you get there and you have the full stadium. My dad was always bad about when he finally got to the top. He was finished. He wanted to go.
He achieved his goal, and then he needed another challenge.
Yeah, he did. He had worked to get it there, and now there it is. I've seen it. I'm done. I'm gonna sell it, and I got to do it somewhere else. So I don't do it again. You know. So you know, and I kind of had that mentality, and when I went to Florida, my second year in Florida, they opened up a brand new building in West Palm Beach, Florida, and the office was in Tampa in the Florida territory.
The Sportatorium?
And they sent me down. Yeah, the old Sportatorium, the old snake pit, man. I don't know if y'all know stories about the snake pit, but that building, if that building could talk, wow.
I'm actually the biggest fan ever of the Studcast, so I know all about the snake pit. It's Stu Hart's Dungeon times 10.
Oh my God, man. That's about it right there. You know,
Where boys become men.
Yes, sir. You know, and when I went into Florida, I was one of the first guys in the snake pit. I was like, wow, well, I'm gonna learn to shoot, man. Who wouldn't? You know, I mean, how could you be a wrestler and not want to find out, man, how you really make it happen, how you really hurt people, you know, what really goes on, you know? And so, you know, I was into that for a year and a half, and I got sent to West Palm Beach to promote that town, to learn how to promote a town, learn how to do the publicity, go to the TV every Saturday, make sure all the stuff runs like it's supposed to run. You know, then a couple of years after that, I took a vacation, went up to into the Smokies, came up to Knoxville. I hung out in Knoxville for about 4 days. Saturday afternoon, on the last day I was there, I turned on my TV and there was the wrestling show on, and it was the worst show I'd ever seen. It was horrible. I mean, the commentator was out, "There's another warp your head off hold, and a warp your head off hold. There's another one." I mean, it was like, I was like, wow, this is horrible, man. I was used to Gordon Solie in the Florida production and the Sportatorium. So, you know, I sat there with my wife and I said, I wonder how you could get involved in this. So I ended up buying the guy out that owned it, and I built my first territory in Knoxville, called Southeastern.
Wow.
And
what's it like going from being, obviously you've been a promoter's son, promoter's grandson, you know, what's it like going from that to being one of the boys to being the boss? Like, how do you deal with that dynamic of being, you know, obviously you're a wrestler, but you also, you're the boss and the booker. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a little bit of a challenge. But at the same time, I was really, really lucky. When I went to Florida, I was a young boy, 1 year, 22, 23 years old. And I was surrounded by young talent. They had a lot of great, Dick Slater and Bob Orton Jr. and Bob Roop, and just a ton of Mike Graham, Steve Kern.
Yeah,
you know, Steve was in that about that same time frame. All these young wrestlers, man, and at that point I was just a wrestler too. So, you know, I was just one of the boys, man, and we always had a little clique. All the younger stars, you know, you had the big stars, the Jack Briscoes and the guys, the Johnny Valentines and the guys that had been in the business for years. But we got this young group of young guys that were all, you know, eager to get it done, man, to make a star of themselves. And so once I went to Southeastern, I just dipped into all my friends back there, man. I brought in Slaters and I brought in the Mike Grahams and I brought in these young guys that had worked with me as a regular wrestler when I was just a wrestler. But it was never difficult for me to be the man, the owner. I mean,
you're 6'9".
Yeah, well, you know, that helped a lot. You know, it wasn't like I was a George Gulas. Right.
But no, and also sounds like you surrounded yourself with talent, with true professionals, and that were motivated. And you had the same goal. They wanted to see you succeed. You wanted to see them succeed. So it sounds like it worked. I mean, you didn't bring in people that weren't going to work hard, weren't going to put in the effort, weren't going to, you know, do everything they could to make your promotion the best that it could be.
And you learned from your dad too to have that core group, like, you know, he had the Sputnik Monroes, right, the Billy Wicks.
There you go,
man. You could trust.
You know, the Mario Galintos. I mean, he had his own posse, and I'm sure you mirror imaged, you know, the same thing, to have your core group that had your back.
I did the same thing exactly, guys. I laid my hands on some of the greatest talent, not just these young guys. I had guys that were opening matches that were just phenomenal, man. And then I put on, then I added to them Bob Armstrong and the Mongolian Stomper and Joe LeDuc and Tony Charles. And some of the greatest stars, the older guys too. I had a tremendous product, man. I had a great product. I had an 80 share. I got people watching my stuff. And And I think guys respected me. They, you know, when I first started, I was 25 years old. I was the territory owner at 25 years old. Pretty crazy, man. Really, really kind of in an odd situation. But I never really had problem getting respect from guys. As it seemed like, they understood that what I could do, and I had proven myself. You know, I had done pretty well.
And also, you had that great, you know, business acumen or that business sense. I mean, you knew when to, when the crowds are down, you knew when to cut matches off the card. You know that some nights it wasn't time to have five matches. It was time to have four matches. You might have a couple opening matches and you have two main events or something like that. You knew how to adjust the business model for what was going on at the time period.
Yeah, and it was all important. That was very critical things, that some promoters never got a feel for. But I'd grown up in the business, yeah. And I'd seen it done so many different ways. Now I had my own little group. So in 1974, I go in there and I started assimilating my crew. By 1977, Mongolian Stomper been with me for 4 years, Bob Armstrong for 4 years. I had a lot of these, Don Carson, these veterans that could get it done. And so when I got ready to expand, I went down and bought the Fields territory. I actually had two territories running, 1978 and 1979. I was operating a territory on the Gulf and a separate territory in Knoxville.
When did you...
Both of them selling out.
And when did you start having a working relationship with Memphis again, with Jared? Did that start around that time when he took over?
Yeah, I actually my relationship started with Jerry in 1975. I came to Knoxville in 1974. That territory was bad. It was kind of like the territories that I'd seen my dad go through. It was down. They didn't have very good crowds, and I had to build it. And I was in a position where I couldn't run. It wasn't a territory. Knoxville had never been a territory. It had always just been a town. He ran Knoxville on Friday night. Sometimes he'd run a little show close to Knoxville on Saturday. I wanted the territory. So my long-term plan was to build a six-night, seven-night-a-week territory there. And short trips, and I was able to accomplish all that. And the short trips really helped me because I come out of Florida and I'd come out of Georgia and places where they had these long trips and long drives. And Stars didn't want to, Stars made money, but they didn't want to drive. They didn't want to make these long trips. So I turned my Knoxville territory into longest trip was 140 miles.
Oh, wow.
So they could be home by midnight every night. And that helped me get some of the best talent in the world because guys say, geez, man, yeah, they're making $1,000 a week there. And they're home every night
home
by
every
midnight.
Night. Yeah,
and that probably helped with some of the boys' wives and stuff too. Like, I'm gonna take a hard way, honey, but I'll be home by midnight.
There you go. Yeah, you know. So yeah, it worked out really, really great because it was ideal. Then I go down to the Gulf Coast, and I had almost the same situation there. They were fairly short trips there. I had Mobile, Pensacola, Panama City. Along the Gulf there, Dothan, Alabama, which was just very, very close to all that. Montgomery was only 100 miles north of Mobile, basically. And, so I had the same thing going on in the Southern Territory. Totally different crew. And I now would be able to swap those guys back and forth. Whenever I wanted to put a mega show together, I would throw guys from the north into the south and now south into the north. I mean, it just really, really worked. Really well for me.
Of course, in Memphis, we had, one time, Billy Wicks, the big baby face. We had Jackie Fargo, the torch was passed to Jerry Lawler. Like, say in your Knoxville territory, who was your longest running big star there? Who was your draw?
Well, Ron Wright was he was a star when I came there. And he was the only guy I kept that was in that crew because I liked Ron Wright and he was so over there. And I needed somebody to get started to get me off the ground. I had never been a heel before. When I went to Knoxville, I turned heel. I looked at the crew and who was there and who can I use.
Was that around 79?
I get this thing. That was a 70, that I beat 75.
Okay, 75.
And 75, and I struggled that first 2 years, both certainly the first year and on into the second year before I ever got it getting off the ground. But that's where Jerry and I came in. So 1974, I bought the territory in, I think it was October of 74. And Jerry called me in November of 74, and he said, Ron, he goes, and I hadn't seen Jerry in years, but I think he knew what I'd done in Florida. And I'd been doing a lot of stuff, guys. I was really, really lucky. In 1973 and 74, Sam Muchnick got a look at me in Australia. And Sam Muchnick in St. Louis, he liked me. Sam had the biggest wrestling city in the NWA. He was the president of the NWA. He was the man. And Sam took a liking to me. At 25 years old, I was working on top in St. Louis. So, you know, that really helped me to kind of make a name for myself. And Sarge, you got everybody from all over the country wrestling in St. Louis. He only put the big guys in the sport on those St. Louis cards. So I think Jerry found out about a little bit of that in 73 and 74. So when I came to Knoxville, Jerry called me up and he said, Ron, he goes, would you like to work for me here in Memphis? And I wasn't doing very well at this point. My territory was really down. I wasn't making any money. I didn't have any territory to work in. I was only running two nights a week. And I said, what do you pay me, Jerry? And he said, $1,000 a show.
Whoa.
1975. I said, Jerry, are you serious? And he goes, yes. He goes, Ron, I've seen your shit. He goes, I want you. He goes, my territory's down. And it was down. When I went in there and started working, I remember first houses I worked on in late 1974. He put the strap on me the last match in 1974. He put the title on me there, the Southern title. And then I remember January and February, there were some of those crowds were 3,000, which was really horrible. It looked horrible in the Mid-South, right? I mean, it was like, God, man, this is terrible. By April, we were doing 11,000.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it really cranked up, man, big time. And Dad came in, he wrestled some with Rob. You had Bill Dundee and George Barnes.
Yep.
The Aussie connection, and I'd been in Australia for months working with those guys.
Didn't your dad and Jim Barnett have you be a shooter over in Australia with the crowd?
Yeah, I used to do the shooting deal, with the crowd, but this was after, they coming to into the snake pit in 71 and 72. And when I went to Australia, Dad says, hey, I want you to do the shooter deal, man. We're going to go and let anybody from the crowd challenge you. And so we did some of that there.
Who trained you as far as shooting holds go?
The guys that were in the, there were all kinds of different guys that were coming through the Florida territory, and Eddie Graham loved to have the shooters. Gordon Nelson, English guy.
Yep.
There was a bunch of English guys that Robinson.
Yes, that's, I'm a big MMA fan, so long time MMA fan. And so, and I always explain that the history of mixed martial arts isn't necessarily UFC. It's professional wrestling and the holds and shooting and all that. So to have the true shooters, true catch as can wrestling, the real shoot style is professional wrestling. That's where it comes from. Yeah.
So basically, these guys would be in there. He'd bring them in the territory just for the snake pit. And the snake pit, I don't know if you guys know a whole lot about it. Well, you said you listen to Studcast, so you know a heck of a lot about that. Basically, the snake pit was where you taught marks what the business was all about.
Right.
You know, and usually it was the type of mark that needed it too. Somebody that thought, oh, geez, this is all fake.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like I said, I'm a big fan of the Studcast, and I've listened to a lot of episodes, and I've probably listened to many more. I'm going to need a room at your house, Ron, because I'm going to get kicked out the house. You know, I've become such a big fan, but, you know, anyway. But, you know, and I think it's important for the audience to know, too, that not only was it important for far as inside the business being a shooter, at that time it was important outside the business, because that was the heightened time where you would go to a bar or restaurant or something like that, and the, you know, guy gets in your face, well, how fake is it, and, you know, and all this and that. So that was actually the time, you know, where kayfabe, you know, alive and well, you really had to protect yourself when you went out in public.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there was no better training than that snake bit, I can tell you that, Glenn. And there were just, there was a group of guys that were always there. Bob Roop was in there, Hero Matsuda.
Oh, yes, legendary Hero Matsuda. Broke Hogan's leg. real shooter.
You know, Matsuda, you know, there were just three or four of us that were constantly there, and I would always show up. I was one of the guys. And thankfully, you know, I got into the rotation, basically, is what I called it. Eddie would show up, and he'd have the marks up front, and he'd bring them back. And then, you know, Ron, it's your turn. You know, Bob Roop, it's your turn. And Hero, this one's yours. Jack Briscoe was in there a hell of a lot. Wow. You know, they ain't no better than that, you know. Jack didn't know a whole lot of shooting holes. But Jack was he was the greatest. You know, you couldn't beat Jack. You couldn't touch Jack Briscoe.
No.
You know, and then when you started teaching him shooting holes, you know, wow. He was, and Jack loved it. So, so just as an example, Nelson, you know, Nelson was in there. Gordon Nelson was in there, and it was the first time anybody ever saw the sugar hold. And I don't know if you remember this or if you you know much about it, but it was a hole that nobody had ever seen before, and it was a shooting hole, and it was the easiest, most simple shooting hole to get. It was unbelievable, and so the first time we ever saw this, there was probably that day there was a bunch of people in there. It was Lester Welch and a lot of other wrestlers that were older guys. For some reason, I think it's because Gordon Nelson was there, and Gordon Nelson got this sugar hold on a mark, and everybody just kind of went up to the ring, because you could hear the guy making these noises. You knew that this guy was in horrible pain. He's making all these noises and. So we're easing up there to get a
can you describe the hold? Can you describe the hold?
Is it something like a hammerlock, somewhere like that, or?
Well, if you can imagine, so you've got a guy on this side, okay? And you reach underneath his top arm. He's got an arm that's sticking out above, right? You reach under that arm, and you run your arm down behind his neck, and you get your hand inside his other arm. So that he's got both his arms out straight, and you're on top of him with your arm barred in there behind his neck. Okay? You got both of his arms stretched out behind his neck.
Kind of like a Nelson. Kind of like, sort of like a full Nelson.
Yeah, full Nelson, but it's not a standing move. It's always got to be on the mat.
Okay.
He's got to be on his side on the mat. You've got him. You've got your arm down there barred behind his neck. You've got both of his arms under your arm. And then you just kind of reach down and get his hip and start cranking your body around that drives his head down into his chest.
Ah.
And you can crank it to where you, well, so here's the deal, and you'll probably like this story. We all ease up there to the ring, man, and this guy's, boy, he's really hurt. And we're like, wow, what's he got? You know, I mean, I can't figure this out. And so Lester, who is one of my relatives, my dad's uncle, basically, Roy's brother, Lester asked Gordon Nelson, he says, what you got there? And Gordon's talking just like it, you know, he's not even struggling to get this done, right? He goes, I've got my sugar hold up. And he goes, well, how bad can you hurt him? And he said, well, about another 30 seconds, he'd be bleeding out of his ears. We all really perked up then, bleeding out of his ears in 30 more seconds.
Right? Disclaimer, children, please do not try this at home. Maybe some adults don't try it either.
Yeah, man, I mean, this is a bona fide badass thing here, man. Really, really a hook and hold. And we all just backed off. I mean, as this was the scenario in the snake pit, then everybody, once the mark, they carried him out, once they trucked him out of there, then everybody got right in there with Gordon. Show me. You know, you had to, and you know, and when the guy like that, that's his bread and butter hold, man, you can't learn from any better than that. You know, he was all the fine points. No, you got to just, you know, you got your arm a little too deep, and you got the head up higher on the head. You know, all the just the little things that make these shooting holes.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
And from a jiu-jitsu standpoint, you're controlling his hips, so he can't move. And once you control the hips and you have the arms, it's over.
It's over. And then you can, and it's just how bad you want to hurt him at that point, you know. And most of the guys will be screaming long before they get to the point where they bleed out of the ears, no doubt. But I got all that training, man. I got to spend the time in the snake pit and all that stuff, and it was really, really good for me. And when you get that reputation, people know you've been there, right? You never have a problem in the ring. I never had a problem ever in the ring, you know, especially after I did my year and a half in snake pit. Because wrestlers knew that, hey, this guy,
probably don't want to try him.
Yeah, he might not want to mess with him.
Not going to go into business for myself.
Yeah.
Ron, you've really inspired me. Willie B, after the interview, hang around. I'm going to put you in the sugar hole. We're going to see how this works out for you. Well, Ron, you're one of these guests, man, brother, and thank you so much for doing this with us. We could actually sit here and talk to you till like next Tuesday and still only cover 12% of your family's history, legacy, and your career. So, you know, I got a final question for you too. Tell the audience how you came up with the name the Tennessee Stud.
Well, I'll tell you, and when I went to wrestled in Tennessee, when I bought the territory in Tennessee, I look different than most wrestlers. I mean, being 6'9", it always gives you a different look. And I wanted to have a good gimmick here, something that would really be recognizable. I didn't know exactly what it was that I wanted. And I spent 3 months, I went to work, like I said, in Memphis, and I was in Memphis from January on into the summer of 1975, every Monday night, about 3 months in, I got the name. And the way I got the name is I was riding home from wrestling in Chattanooga one night, and a song came on. It was Johnny Cash singing the Tennessee Stud. And I listened to that song, and I went, son of a gun. By the time that song was over, I said, that's me. That's what I am. I'm the Tennessee Stud.
Tennessee Stud.
I had my history wrong. I thought that it was probably the Eddie Arnold version, but it was the Johnny Cash version.
Yeah, I think it was Johnny Cash. I believe it was Johnny Cash. But I know two or three or four different people did that song, you know. But I believe it was Johnny Cash that was on that night. So I just said, man, you know, that's got a real hook to it, man. I believe that'll get it done. It's so important, man, as a wrestler to have more than just your normal name. If you can get yourself a nickname, and I was healing. I'd never healed in my life, you know, so it fit. It was just perfect. It helped me really get over in Memphis, and it helped me get Jerry's territory up for him big time. I worked with Jack Briscoe, twice in April of 1975.
Was that during his title run?
Yeah.
He was in WWE
World Champion.
World Champion.
All right. I wrestled Jack Briscoe 2 weeks in two out of 4 weeks in April 1975. 11,300 people.
Wow.
Both shows.
And explaining what a big deal wrestling the NWA champion, like that was a massive, massive big deal back in those days.
Oh, gee. Yes, man. And it was crazy. I'm going to tell you one thing here real, real quick, man. I have a record of all my matches, and it's pretty hard to come by that somebody did this for me. And on September 1st in 1973, I was 25 years old. I lived in West Palm Beach, and I challenge any wrestler anywhere in the world to tell me that they did anything near this, accomplished this in one day. I got up and got on a plane. I flew to St. Louis, Missouri. I wrestled three times, three TV shows back to back. Johnny Valentine, first show. Gene Kaninsky, second show. Terry Funk, show, third show.
R.I.P. Terry Funk.
Okay. Okay.
That's a who's
then who. I got on the plane and flew to Tampa and went across the Howard Franklin Bridge then to St. Pete and wrestled Dusty Rhodes. In nine hours, from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 10 o'clock that night, I wrestled three present or former world champions and Johnny Valentine.
Man, legends. Absolute, the who's who of professional wrestling.
All those world champions at 25 years old. So, and that was because, like I said, Sam Mutchie could take in a liking to me. And the deal was Jack Briscoe told me, he said, Ron, they're curing. They're setting you up, man. They're looking at you. And he knew, because he was world champion, he knew he'd been there. He said they did the same thing with him. They took him into St. Louis for 2 years. Every show in St. Louis for 2 years before he became world champion, he worked in St. Louis. And they did the same thing to me. They started bringing me in there in 73, worked me into 74. And I think they might have put the belt on me had I not decided that I wanted to own my own company.
Yeah.
Our job, before we go, our job is to keep the memories alive and everything like that. And we definitely want this generation, to know about the greatness and the origins and where all this stuff comes from. Before we go, talk about your website and talk about one of the greatest wrestling podcasts the world has ever seen, the Studcast. I want to hear about the website and the Studcast, Ron.
Okay. My website is TN Stud. It's real simple. Initials of the state of Tennessee, tnstud.com. I got all my studcasts on there. I just did number 314.
Wow.
Yesterday. 6 years. 6 years I've been doing them every week. They're everyone on that stud on my website. Every studcast. I've done super studcasts with guys live. Lawler, Dundee, guys that are in the Memphis there, Coco Beware, David Schultz, Honky Tonk Man,
Wayne guys, Ferris,
greatest international champion of all time.
There you go, and you know who trained David Schultz and Coco Beware and Wayne Cowan, Honky Tonk, Herb Welch.
Oh.
My grandfather's brother trained all those guys.
Crazy.
So, got the history, man. Three Hall of Famers to Herb trained right from that general area over there. So I've got these 43 of these super stud casts, they call it, about 2 hours long, live shows with these stars, most of them live. I have a YouTube channel. The Southeastern Rewind is the name of it. YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's got a lot of my shows, my Southeastern stuff, my Continental shows, after I had Southeastern, I created an even bigger territory, Continental.
Yep.
And then USA Wrestling. Some of those shows are on there. Every one of the studcasts are on that YouTube channel. And I have a streaming channel, ClassicContinentalWrestling.com streaming channel. So I got a whole lot going on, man, still with wrestling. And, you know, after being out of it and running hockey teams and being in ADT business, I've done it all, my man. You know, I've done it all, basically. I could spend probably as much time as I did today with you guys talking about hockey.
Yeah.
And, which is a tremendous story in itself about what I was able to do with hockey. I changed the sport for them all.
Yeah, we had the River Kings. We had a minor league team, the River Kings in Memphis they moved to South Haven. They were down here for over 20 years. You're bringing hockey to Nashville is probably what set off bringing hockey to the Memphis area.
Yeah, I think it did. I started my deal in '89, man.
Right, the River Kings came to Memphis around '92, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know they all copied it. They all copied my hockey stuff. And I had the guys from the NHL come the first night to Nashville because I was a wrestler. And they came to see what I was going to do to their game. That's what they told me. They came into my office and said, "We're here to see what you're going to do to our game." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Come back after the first period. We'll talk again." And they went out, and there had never ever been an intro of a hockey game in the history of the sport. And they came back after the opening that we had set up that night. And wow, they were pissed. They were like, "What are you doing, man?" Because we darkened the building, we put the spotlight. We do everything they do now. They got it from me, man.
The innovator.
We did it. It had never been done. They'd never seen that before. Those guys were like pissed about it. And I finally got mad at them, and I said, "Hey, listen," I go, "I own this damn club." I said, "I'm not in the NHL." I said, "I want to ask you guys a question." I said, "How many people were sitting down when that game started?" And they looked at each other, and I said, "Y'all weren't either, were you?"
Uh-oh.
I said, "Because everybody was standing up, right?"
I said,
"Have you ever seen a hockey game start with everybody standing up?" And they all looked. They looked at each other again. I said, "Get out of my office, you son of a bitch."
You brought the showmanship of professional wrestling to the sport of hockey.
I turned it on.
Yes,
I turned them on.
You showed
them
how to. Showed them how to promote.
First, your dad's kicking ringside ticket holders out, and you're kicking people out of your office.
All right, guys.
And I don't want to, you know, I want to make sure we upplay this as much as possible, too. I want to let the audience know this is a huge, huge, huge deal for us to, you know, add another wrestling legend, you know, to our show, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Ron doesn't, you know, Ron has his own thing going on. It's like I said, it's viral. It's very successful. He doesn't do a lot of these. So to have him as a guest is a huge, huge deal for us, and it was almost like a light screening application process to get you. And I feel honored that you was willing to do this with us, Ron. I really do, and I don't want to downplay that at all. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for willing to give us a chance.
Well, I thank you guys. You know, and I appreciate being on with you, and I love the fact that you're from Memphis over there, and you're in one of the greatest wrestling cities that's ever been. And you know, I love having an opportunity to tell fans about the history of the sport, man.
Yes.
And I guess I don't think there's a family out there that's got more than ours.
No, there. It's funny to see how many, you know, professional wrestling has the Grahams, has McMahons, has the Von Erichs. I know I'm missing a few, but there is no family as big, and it's truly, you're the wrestling's royal family. There's not as a family near as big as yours. It's so involved and goes so far back in the wrestling
over business. 100 years, four generations.
Yep.
So guys, Ron, thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
man.
Sir. We appreciate you.
We appreciate you, Ron. And once again, thank you so much for doing our show, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.